Cape Talk, Pippa's Planet.
Well, seeing as we're in the Walker Bay area, we thought we'd tap into some of the local expertise today and chat about one of the key environmental issues that is particularly relevant to this region. I know when you think of Hermanus, you automatically think of whales, but one of the other giants of the deep is equally important to the marine ecosystem here, and that's the shark. And the South African Shark Conservancy is an NGO based in Hermanus that is all about promoting conservation and the sustainable use of our marine resources. And as the name suggests, their research is primarily focused on sharks and their habitats. Now, it's a great pleasure to welcome to our temporary studio today marine biologist Megan McCord, who's the founder and director of the SA Shark Conservancy. Megan, thanks so much for popping through.
Good afternoon, Philip. Pippa, thank you. And thank you to your listeners for tuning in.
I hope our listeners will have questions for you. Just to remind them, please feel free to call through on 021-446-0567 or leave a voice note on 072-567-1567. If there's something you've always been curious about when it comes to sharks or their interaction with humans, what they eat, how far they swim, how big they grow, anything like that, you're welcome to give us a call. Megan, I'm intrigued about your own connection to sharks, because I'm told you grew up in a landlocked part of central Canada. How did you end up as a marine biologist studying sharks in South Africa?
It's quite a long topic to even discuss today, but let's just cut to the chase. I was really passionate about evolution and dinosaurs, and of course dinosaurs today are extinct, but sharks remain living dinosaurs. In fact, they evolved about 440 million years ago and are even older than the dinosaurs and still exist on our planet today. So naturally led to an interest in that group of animals, and South Africa being one of the shark diversity hotspots of the world just seemed like a natural place to come.
So living dinosaurs that have survived where others did not, what is it about the way they've evolved that has enabled them to do that?
You know, that's also a really good question, and something that I think paleontologists are really trying to figure out. But I think, you know, the adaptable nature of the species and the fact that they are able to shift their diets, they're not entirely specialist feeders, they inhabit many different ocean habitats and can exploit a variety of resources. So that makes them quite special.
Mm. Now, as an NGO, how long have you been in operation, the SA Shark Conservancy, and what actually prompted the formation of this group?
This is our 11th year of operations, and it was actually because of the fact that I'm a Canadian citizen and really struggled to get work here in South Africa that I formed the Shark Conservancy. And our original intent was to focus our research efforts on commercially fished shark species here in South Africa to provide the government with support regarding those species. Since then, we've evolved a little bit and are now focused on oceans in general and ecosystems and trying to figure out what the role of sharks are in those environments.
Now, I think most people know the shark is the apex predator. So if you ask them the role of a shark in any environment, that would probably come to mind. But what else, what other role do they play besides being the big cheese at the top of the tree?
Well, you know, most sharks actually are under 2 meters in length, and quite a few of them we wouldn't really categorize as apex predators. We'd categorize them as mesopredators, or animals that sit in the middle of the food chain. And you know, there's not a lot of quantitative research out there that indicates how important that role is, but you can imagine any functioning component of a trophic or a food web is very important. Mm. And you also get the filter feeding sharks, like basking sharks and whale sharks, which, you know, the jury's still out, are they apex predators or not, but they are filter feeding and feed on things like zooplankton.
Yeah. I'm told you were part of the extraordinary research into the presence of sharks in the Breda River. Won't you tell us a little bit more about that project?
Oh, that was an amazing project and sort of a life goal, really. We were very, very lucky to work with a fantastic recreational fisherman who helped us catch and tag the world's largest bull shark in 2009. And this was a 4-meter female bull shark who we subsequently tracked using a hydrophone system for almost 350 hours.
And, I mean, where did she go? What did she do in that time?
She actually, through the whole duration of the tracking of her, remained in the Breda River. And unfortunately, the tag types that we were using at the time didn't allow us to record her movements outside of that system. We had to physically follow her around in the river. But since that time, we've tagged 10 bull sharks in that river, and some of them have made incredible movements up to Mozambique, to Bazaruto, in fact, wow. A journey of over 2,000 kilometers in 50 days.
That's amazing. I mean, you've spoken about the adaptability of these creatures. I think many people would be surprised to hear of any marine species moving from an ocean ecosystem into a river ecosystem and back again. For starters, the saltwater content must differ greatly.
Absolutely, and it's something that is very energetically expensive for something like a bull shark. So they are one of few species of shark that are able to actively osmoregulate or control the salt content of their body compared to the salt content of the environment around them. And that does really distinguish them amongst the sharks. You know, there's only 5 or 6 other species that are able to do that. But it is energetically expensive. It comes at a cost to the animal. It means they have to feed more. And physiologically, it's just very stressful for them.
Okay. Speaking of feeding more, what are the big barriers to overcome in the shark conservation journey is the fear from humans that they are shark food. We know it's not the truth. We know that the so-called shark attacks are accidental encounters. Do you still find that that's a myth you have a lot of difficulty overcoming?
Without a doubt, that's probably the biggest problem we face today is misperception of sharks. And the last week, we've actually been working with a group of youth from La Reunion, an island in the Western Indian Ocean that has been highly affected by shark attacks in recent years and fatalities caused by shark bite incidents. And that's had huge economic impacts on the ecotourism industry in that island, as well as on the mental state of people who live on an island. So very few of them know how to swim, and many of them are terrified of sharks. But the last week has been working with these kids, you know, the leaders of tomorrow, to really try and change their perceptions of these animals and empower them to become stewards for the ocean instead of fear the ocean and fear the animals that live in it.
The movie industry doesn't help you, does it?
Not at all.
I watched a film called The Shallows just a week or so ago, and I, you know, all the way watching the movie, you going, this is ridiculous. At a mental level, I know that sharks don't behave in the way this gigantic creature on the screen is behaving, but it's got a huge sort of lingering impact on people who watch those films, particularly as youngsters. What do you actually do with the youth, for example, these youth from La Reunion? Do you take them into the ocean and show them sharks in a sort of a safe environment? What do you do?
With all of the youth that we work with, we try and make it as experiential as possible, because there's no sense in just lecturing to people. You need to physically demystify these animals and take them out and become a marine biologist for a day. Touch sharks, get involved in tagging sharks with us. We even took them white shark cage diving on Wednesday, and, you know, really getting them to see these animals in the ocean and see the difficulties that we face. You know, we don't put our lines in the water and immediately pull up 5,000 sharks. It takes time to catch these animals, to be able to tag them, to be able to learn about them, so they're not these overabundant man-eating machines that the media would have us believe.
Now, cage diving, I mean, it's always controversial. There are many people who think it shouldn't be done, that it may impact on the way sharks behave, that we start to associate them, to get them associating humans with food. You've obviously found a way to work with the cage diving industry for the conservation process. What are your feelings about the tourism aspect of cage diving?
It's a very complicated topic, and I think if cage diving is done responsibly and there's no provisioning or feeding of the sharks by the operators, then it is unlikely the sharks will become conditioned to the boats and to the humans that run the boats. The jury scientifically is still out about this type of thing. It's very hard to study and very hard to quantify. But I think responsible ecotourism that aims to educate and demystify wild animals has a really incredibly important value. And let's face it, the town of Hansbaai is very reliant on the ecotourism industry and the money that industry brings into the town.
Yeah. Could they do more good than harm if they have that responsible attitude that it's about watching these animals in their natural environment and allowing people to develop an appreciation for their beauty and a respect for their power, rather than that fear that so many people have from ignorance?
I do believe that there are a number of very responsible cage diving operators in Gans Bay and Klein Bay. However, there are still some issues. You know, when people go out to see white sharks, it's the bucket list species that they see on National Geographic. They're gaping, their teeth are showing. People really want to see that, and they want to be scared. There's something about our little monkey brains that likes that. And, you know, those are the difficulties, because the operators are faced with the challenge of ensuring their clients have that experience while also trying to educate. Mm. And some do it more effectively than others.
Okay. If you've just joined us late to the conversation, let me recap that you're listening to marine biologist Megan McCord, who's the founder and director of the SA Shark Conservancy based in Hermanus, all about shark conservation and education. In Walker Bay itself, do you have a sense of how big the shark populations are, or is that a figure that changes throughout the year?
That's actually something that we're trying to figure out. And one of our overarching goals is really to understand, it's called population dynamics. So, you know, how many of certain species are in our area, and what are their characteristics, and how must we best manage and conserve or protect those? And really, can they feed into sustainable fisheries, mm-hmm. which is also important for our communities? We've got about 62 different species of, we call them chondrichthyans, which are sharks, skates, rays, and chimera. And those are the group of animals that have this cartilaginous skeleton, mm-hmm. like our ears. So 62 species in our waters, many of whom are not managed at all. And we think it's really important to fill in the knowledge gaps and feed back to national government on these animals.
Of those 62 species, how many would be listed as endangered or at least under threat?
There are approximately 32% of the species that we know occur in the Walker Bay area are considered near threatened by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, who's responsible for assessing the conservation status of these animals.
Email in from Mario, who would like to know why there's still shark nets in the Durban coast, because it financially benefits the cage industry in Cape waters. In Durban, it's financially viable to net the beaches. Any thoughts on those, the use of shark nets?
That is a fairly archaic practice that was put in place following Black December and a number of fatal shark incidents that happened along the KZN coast. And it was a government's knee-jerk reaction to protect the tourism industry there, which is really important. And the KZN Sharks Board themselves are mandated by the provincial government to have those nets in place. The Sharks Board are always trying to develop alternative ways of dealing with shark-human conflict that won't always result in the mortality of these animals, given that we know so much about their declining populations now. So the long and the short of it is it's governmental red tape and an unwillingness to shift policy, I suppose, to protect humans and ensure long-term economic benefits to the area.
Okay. Interesting question in from Leanne, who'd like to know if there's any impact on sharks here in Walker Bay from the whales arriving each year. Is that a relationship, if there is such a relationship, that you've studied?
Great question. And in fact, no, we don't yet know the answer to that. But we do assume that the abundance of calving southern right whales and the, you know, the afterbirth and stuff that is left behind is an important food resource for a number of sharks in our area. But it's really difficult thing to study, but I think would be incredible in the long term to try and understand. Okay. So sorry, Leanne, I can't answer that.
Still to be answered in future. I mean, I know you spend a huge amount of time out there in the field, in the water, something like half the month, if the weather conditions allow. What have you observed when you're out there studying sharks in their natural habitat, particularly about their interaction, if any, with humans using the bay? I mean, this is, after all, a very popular tourist destination, this bay. There are large numbers of holidaymakers using the beaches and the water. Do the sharks interact with them at all? For those of us going swimming at Hermanus, would we be surprised by how many are out there not too far away?
Well, I think everybody would be surprised. You know, since the beginning of January, we've tagged almost 300 sharks in Walker Bay, and I would like to just say that those are not all white sharks. So people needn't be afraid to put their toe in the ocean. These are all some of our endemic species, you know, small sharks that are only up to about 1.7 meters total length, and very harmless for humans.
Okay. What about the impact of our fishing for our own human consumption on their diets? There's, we know, huge problems with overfishing. overfishing and depletion of fish stocks, how does that impact on a shark's diet?
We can only imagine that it's having a significant impact on the populations of sharks in our area. And, you know, we're seeing it with the penguins. We're seeing declines in their populations because there aren't enough sardines left in the water. Mm. They're being overfished. And we suspect that the same trickle-down impacts are happening here with sharks. But, again, it's incredibly difficult to study these interactions on animals that you cannot see and cannot physically keep an eye on. So long-term collection of data and monitoring of these population trends and catch rates over time will hopefully shed some light into those questions.
Okay. Another question in from Max, going back to that mention of the bull sharks in the Breda River. He said that bull shark that traveled all the way to Mozambique, is that the longest you've ever tracked a shark, or have others gone further?
That was the longest we've ever seen a bull shark migrate in southern Africa before, and that was done using something called a satellite tag. So we didn't physically track the animal ourselves, but it did transmit data to satellite systems.
What other sort of technology can you use to track sharks? So, I mean, I think most people would be familiar with the concept of a satellite tag. For example, drones, can they be used in your work?
They absolutely are, and they're being used in many different ways now to study sharks, especially in areas where there's a high degree of human-shark overlap. Mm-hmm. Of course, here in South Africa, we have wind problems, and flying drones in the coastal environment to track sharks is challenging at the best of times. When the southeaster is blowing, or the northwester, or the southerly, it's even more challenging.
Okay. We had a chat on the show a couple of weeks ago about the concept of citizen science and how divers and snorkelers in the Cape can get involved in studies of fish populations, etc. Is that something that you're open to as the Shark Conservancy, that involving the local population and the tourists, etc., as part of your studies?
Absolutely. I mean, for the last several years, we've been working with recreational fishing communities along the entire South African coastline, training them to responsibly handle sharks and tag sharks and feed into our national shark tagging program. In addition to that, we run citizen science research trips here in Walker Bay through our program called Shark Expeditions Africa. And that's focused on just getting people out into the ocean, seeing other animals other than white sharks, learning how science is done, getting hands-on with the sharks and really demystifying them, but getting people to contribute to it as well.
And if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, please visit the website www.sharkconservancy.org. Megan McCord, the founder and director of the SA Shark Conservancy, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Pippa, and thank you to the listeners.
Great to have you with us.